Simon in Walmart versus AIJ.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Richard Hines of Ashby and Geddes for Appellee AIG Life Insurance Company. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, James Jordan of Jordan Bird. He'll be making a portion of the argument for appellees today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Dearlow from Richards, Leighton & Finger on behalf of Appellees, the Hartford Life Insurance Company, and ICMG. I'd like to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Barry Chasnoff from Akin Gubb, Howard Strauss & Fell, who will be making a portion of the argument.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to just want to thank the court and other counsel for their indulgence last time when I was ill.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Elise Moen of Blank Rome. On behalf of the Appellees, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Mr. Roger Cox, also of Blank Rome. Mr. Cox will be presenting an argument on behalf of the brokers.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, James Whitney on behalf of the Appellees. It's my pleasure to introduce Marco Schnabel of the New York Bar, who's been admitted pro hoc vice in this action. Mr. Schnabel will not be arguing, but Mr. Cox will be presenting argument on behalf of the brokers, but he is available to answer any questions the court may have that are specific to Marsh.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may I personally apologize if I'd had us here 10 minutes earlier. I understand we could have gotten started earlier.
No problem. We're just going to delete 10 minutes from the total.
Delete it from mine. That's important. As before, Mr. Horton of the firm, Michelle Horton of the firm of Morgan, Lewis & Bacchius will present the argument for the appellant, Walmart. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome back to everyone. You know, even though we've asked for supplemental briefings since the argument is en banc, all issues are before the court, and we are not limiting your argument this afternoon in any way, and we haven't conferred among ourselves in any way. And the clocks have been set with four different programs. Whenever your program starts, you'll see your total time, and then it'll be counting down from that so you know how much time you have left. Very well.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Horton. I'm with Morgan, Lewis & Bacchius. I represent Walmart Stores, Inc., Walmart Stores Grantor Trust, Learned Counsel. Thank you for this appearance. The hardest part of argument for me is knowing where to start. It's our third time here, so even third time's a charm or three strikes you're out. I'm not sure which metaphor is going to apply. Second thing, that I never expected this case to get this complicated. I knew that the Coley policies, the Coley transactions were complicated, but I never set out to create new law or assert new causes of action. I thought we were working with pretty well-settled doctrines and precedent. But let me tell you the facts, as I've pleaded them and as I know them to the best of my knowledge, and then let me talk about the claims that I believe are derived from those facts. Walmart is not in the insurance business. Walmart deals regularly with brokers in terms of purchasing many types of insurance. 1993, along with about half the other 500 Fortune companies in the country, Walmart started exploring COLI insurance as a way to have tax savings and to provide benefits to its employees. I don't know if Walmart approached the brokers first on this or whether the brokers approached them. I don't think it makes a difference. The fact of the matter is they had an ongoing relationship with Marsh, and out of that relationship arose discussions as to whether COLI would be an appropriate mechanism to save Walmart money through the tax benefits and to allow it to provide benefits. The COLI brokers that were ultimately selected by Walmart were Marsh, NBG, National Benefits Group, which is a joint venture with Marsh, Seabury and Smith, which worked with NBG and is now, I believe, part of Marsh, but I'm not really sure. COLI's not your ordinary insurance. It's not an off-the-shelf product. It is a highly complicated, very technical, computer-driven product and bundle of services that is intended to match actuarial principles that are pretty common in the life insurance industry with tax principles that are provide benefits to life insurance. And it's through the matching of those two doctrines, tax doctrines, insurance doctrines, that the brokers and the carriers who sold these products were able to provide what looked to Walmart and many other companies as a very good tax deferral mechanism that would provide positive cash flow over a long period of time, which was then going to be used for the benefit of their employees. In our supplemental briefing, one of the things we tried to do was to demonstrate to the court that in the tax cases which had dealt with the Coley plans, and all four tax cases have now found that the Coley plans were economic shams. It's AEP, Dow Chemical, Winn-Dixie, and AEP is American Electric Power, and Camelot. Four cases all have found that the Coley transactions are shams and have disallowed all the tax benefits. Coley brokers are a small group of individuals, probably a dozen of them, and they all testified in these tax cases, whether it's with Hartford or Mutual Benefit Life, which was a company before Hartford, or International Corporate Management Group, which was an affiliate of MBL and an affiliate of Hartford that was set up specifically to deal with Coley programs, or AIG Life, a Coley plan provider, or its agent, Westport, which was another subsidiary set up to deal with Coley products. And then a small group of brokers. There's a highly specialized product with highly specialized brokers selling it. And Walmart, from day one, relied on the brokers and the consultants and in direct contact with the insurers in deciding whether to purchase the Coley products, what type of Coley product to purchase, what the terms and conditions would be, what the interest rates would be, and how the products would be handled, at least from Walmart's standpoint. And it's that specialized service that these brokers provide that gives rise to a number of the claims that we have asserted, in particular the fiduciary duty claims and the professional negligence claims, not just standard negligence. We have two claims. We have two types of claims. We have equitable claims, a restitutionary claim, and breach of fiduciary duty claims. We have legal claims, which are contract, misrepresentation, equitable fraud, statutory fraud. When the plans began to unravel, which was in 95, the change in Congress changing the tax laws prospectively for Coley plans, Walmart and the insurers attempted to unwind the plans in accordance with a unwind procedure that had been originally negotiated when the plans were issued from 1993 to June of 1995. And that was something that was built into the plans. A change in the laws prospectively was something that all of the parties contemplated, because there had been a series of tax law changes as Coley, going back 10 years. But in every single one of those changes, the changes have been prospective, not retroactive. The brokers and the carriers and their agents, carrier agents, ICMG and Westport, repeatedly assured Walmart that if there were tax law changes going forward, that there was a pattern of grandfathering that would permit the tax benefits that were extant under the plans at the time they were issued to continue, and that the changes would be prospective only. It's the retroactive change in the tax laws as a result of the four tax cases that I've mentioned that have given rise to Walmart's damages. Walmart is not seeking its lost benefits prospectively. It's not seeking its lost interest deductions retroactively. It is seeking $130 million that it paid to these insurers and to these brokers on a bundle of services and a product that failed. And it failed in its fundamental purpose when the tax benefits that were absolutely integral to the financial viability of these programs were disallowed.
You said retroactive changes. At the time or ongoing, any transaction can be set aside by the IRS as a sham, right?
No question about it, Your Honor. It's the tax laws, the IRS can come in and challenge any type of tax benefit. There's no question about that.
So there's nothing retroactive about that.
Well, I think there is. I mean, I think it is. These tax laws have been in place for about 10 years before Walmart even got into the COLI business. They got into the COLI plans very late in the game, 1993, after these plans had been running for many other companies for many years without challenge by the IRS. So when from Walmart's perspective, and based on the representations from the defendants, these were pretty sound investments with predictable results, and were designed such that if there were prospective law changes, there would be a mitigation of damages feature built into them.
Mr. Horton.
Yes, sir.
Let's go back for a moment to the $130 million figure that you talked about. What does the complaint allege that amount represents? Was that the total amount of premia and consultant's fees, or was it something else?
And I can. When Walmart was negotiating with the IRS to settle, they had an Alabama accountant do an actuarial analysis of what the settlement would result in and how much the losses would be to Walmart. Based on that report that I've seen, the out-of-pocket expenses on premiums, commissions, administrative fees, DAC taxes, and other expenses associated with these policies resulted in losses that I believe we've alleged are $85 million under the AIG program and $50 million under the Hartford program. That's the basis of those allegations, is the accounting study that was done by Walmart in connection with the IRS settlement. It's not their lost tax benefits.
I'm sorry, it's not.
It's not their lost tax benefits.
No, I understand.
As part
that.
Of the damages. But that, so it is premiums again, the difference, commissions. There were administrative fees that were paid on an ongoing basis. There was a mortality charge that was relatively small in this case because the programs were mortality neutral. But that's the difference between the anticipated cost of providing life insurance versus the unanticipated increase in death benefits. And there's always a mortality buffer built into a life insurance program.
Would it be fair to say that your client's effort to recover the $130 million, which represents the elements that you just described, is in the nature of a rescission claim? Excuse me.
You know, that's a $135 million question based on Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision. I mean, I think it's a rescission. I think it has all the earmarks of a rescissionary claim. But the fact of the matter is that these contracts are no longer in existence. They were surrendered by 2000. There is no further performance that is due from the carriers or the brokers. There's no further performance due from Walmart. And I always think of rescission as rescinding an ongoing contract. And Vice Chancellor Lamb certainly does as well, because his ruling is that there can be no restitutionary claim once a contract is fully performed based on a commercial frustration theory. I've looked into that. I was asked at the last argument.
The damage claim appears to be rescissionary from your client's side, putting to one side what effect it might have on the other side of the table.
Well, let me be clear. Our rescissionary claim, under the equitable principles as I understand them, the damages we would be entitled to if we were to receive restitution would be the profits that the defendants made. The $135 million is Walmart's out-of-pocket damages. So on our legal claims, we would be seeking to recover the $135 million. On our equitable claims, all we're seeking and all we'd be entitled to under the equitable principles are the disgorgement of profits so as to restore the status quo ante of the parties prior to the transaction. And I was asked last time, is there a majority rule on whether you can have restitutionary remedies once a contract is performed? I don't know. I looked into it. I've seen the cases that have been cited by Vice Chancellor Lamb. Some of them say that, but then they go on to say that there's questions of fact regarding foreseeability, et cetera. But the basis of the doctrine that says you can't have a restitutionary claim once a contract is performed is to preclude a party from trying to have their cake and eat it too, so that a party can't choose between contract benefits and equitable restitutionary benefits in order to maximize their damage claims. And I don't see any of that. I don't see that that's a possibility. I don't think that Walmart is choosing a restitutionary claim over a contract claim in order to maximize benefits. In fact, the profits they made are substantially less, as far as I can tell, from the damages that Walmart suffered. So our equitable claims, in fact, are seeking less damages than our legal claims are. And I don't know, I can't put my finger on an equitable doctrine that basically says once the contract has been performed and there were flaws in the product or services that were sold that resulted in damages, what is your restitutionary remedy? I don't know if it's unjust enrichment. I don't know if it's mutual estate. I don't know if it's impracticability. I don't know if it's commercial frustration. But and in California, we don't have equity in law that's been merged. But it certainly appears to me that in equity, the court has the capability of doing the right thing. And in a transaction where we have alleged that a product and services were sold to us, developed, marketed, administered, and sold by the defendants to us, and they failed, and we lost a lot of money, and they made a lot of money, that there ought to be an equitable remedy to balance the financial consequences of that transaction. Now, if there isn't, I mean, I've read hundreds of cases in connection with these three arguments, and I certainly can't remember them all, but I do remember some principles in that in every case where the restitution, where a party has pleaded restitution and contract at the same time, there's been a couple of things that happened. If the contract had to provide a clear and explicit remedy in order for the restitutionary claim to be dismissed as a matter of law as being inconsistent with a contract. And if the contract did not, then the party was entitled to plead alternatively. And here, we can't even agree on what the contracts are or were. Portions of the contracts have been submitted to the court for the record. Other portions have not. There are oral contracts with the brokers, not necessarily written contracts. And none of the contracts or portions of contracts that are in the record demonstrate a clear and explicit remedy for the allegations that we've made. Because at the outset of this case, I couldn't determine whether it's equitable, whether it's a matter of law, so I pleaded both. And again, the other principle that's come out of the cases where restitution and contract have been analyzed is that I'm not aware of any case where the restitutionary claim was dismissed without permitting the contract claim to go forward. And I think in Pharmacia, for example, there were misrepresentations that were alleged, and a motion to dismiss the fraud was granted. But it was based on disclaimers. It was based on parties who had equal bargaining power. It was based on very, very broad and explicit disclaimers. In the Mentis case, for example, there was, which dealt with fiduciary obligations, the court dismissed the equitable claims as to the fiduciary relationships, but then went on to find that the breach of contract claim survived the motion to dismiss, that a Consumer Fraud Act claim survived the motion to dismiss, and that whether or not the insurance agent's representations in that case, which dealt with vanishing premium policies, whether those representations were opinions or representations of fact, that determination itself was a question of fact. So I'm not aware of a case that is in the same posture as ours where the restitutionary claims have been dismissed as being inconsistent with the contract claims, which is part of the court's ruling below, and then the legal claims have not proceeded. But that's the posture I'm in here. I have two equitable claims: restitution, fiduciary rights. What are the fiduciary rights based on? Fiduciary rights are based on the very specialized talents of the individuals that we were dealing with, their self-professed expertise in this area, their intent to induce our reliance, the fact that we did rely on them. Walmart's big and sophisticated, no question about it, but they did not have internal expertise in Coley, and that's why they hired with the best and the brightest in the country in this area to advise them. Now, I don't know if that gives rise to fiduciary rights. I've read the cases, and I certainly read Bird's Construction, which Judge Lamb, or Vice Chancellor Lamb, cites in his decision. And Bird's Construction says that, one, it's a cohabitation case where Ms. Kershaw and Mr. Johnson lived together for 10 years. She throws him out after 10 years. He makes a claim for breach of a promise to marry and to have some work that he had done on the farm titled in both names. And the court declined to impose a fiduciary relationship under those circumstances. Now, cohabitation is a far cry different from the commercial relationships that we are dealing with here. So, you know, I've alleged those two equitable causes. But fiduciary, you know, I've also alleged professional negligence. Professional negligence, in my view, is a negligence claim where the standard of care is based on the particular profession that is the defendant. It's not an ordinary standard of care that you would have for one of us walking down the street or driving a car, but it's a heightened standard of care that is determined by the nature of the profession and the level of expertise and talents that go along with that profession. And for example, in California, the standard of care on a professional negligence case is a jury question. What standard of care did this doctor or did this lawyer or did this engineer or did this insurance consultant have to meet is a jury question based on expert testimony, and then whether it is met is also a jury question. I don't know under Delaware law, to be honest with you, what the heightened standard of care for a professional is and how that is measured. We've looked into it. I don't have dispositive authority on it. But the standard of care of a doctor, engineer, an airplane pilot, and a highly technical, highly specialized, highly compensated insurance broker ought to be higher than the ordinary garden variety standard of care for negligence. So we have negligence standard, we have a professional liability standard, and we have fiduciary duties. And where this court draws the line on these claims, I don't know. So I pleaded both. I pleaded that they're fiduciary.
Does your equitable fraud claim fall within the fiduciary duty character?
I don't think so. I don't think the equitable fraud claim requires a fiduciary relationship in order to withstand a motion to dismiss.
It doesn't fall in that category. It stands apart from your fiduciary claim.
Yes. The Consumer Fraud Act claim requires a misrepresentation and an intention to induce reliance. It doesn't require reliance, which differs from equitable fraud. But the duties that form the basis of that equitable fraud claim are based on the standard of care that we believe ought to be imposed on the professionals who were the defendants in this case. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, Your Honor. And if it doesn't, please, I'll try again.
Well, I did have another question.
Yes, sir.
What's the logical relationship between the one of the better term, professional negligence or professional malpractice claims and equitable fraud? As I understand it from the supplemental briefs, the gist of the equitable fraud claim is that the other side knew or should have known that the practices that they were engaging in and counting as being consistent with industry standard were not. And should have been, and the fact that they were not should have been disclosed, so that your client would have been aware of the risk that it was taking on.
Correct.
That's the equitable fraud claim. I gather that the professional negligence claim is that whether or not those facts were disclosed, the other side should not have done something that it did, or did something that it shouldn't have done. And that's a blank slate. I'm not sure exactly how you end that sentence.
The professional negligence claim is brought solely against the brokers, not against the insurers or the insurer agents, which is a distinguishing factor. Two, the professional negligence claims requires reliance by Walmart. which under the Delaware Consumer Fraud Act, reliance is not an element. So the underlying facts that give rise to all the claims are the same. We have 30 pages of facts where we allege that these were elite entrepreneurial group of specialists in this area, that we relied on them, that there were flaws in the programs.
Well, I understand the notes are the same, but the music is different depending on which cause of action we're talking about.
Because of the uncertainty as to which cause would be most appropriate, we've pleaded an array of causes. It's not unusual for plaintiffs to do that. I didn't know what Vice Chancellor Lamb's approach would be, so we pleaded what we thought were the causes that were appropriate. I can live with any one of them. They're all based on the same facts. The only difference is there are certain elements that I have to prove for a Consumer Fraud Act claim that I would not have to prove for professional negligence, that I would not have to prove for breach of contract, or the equitable claims are different. Perhaps in retrospect, I shouldn't have even brought an equitable claim. Perhaps I should have relied solely on the contract, misrepresentation, and the legal causes of action. I don't know. I try not to second-guess myself on that. Vice Chancellor Lamb has made some pretty sweeping statements in his decision, he makes it very clear that if it's on page 622 of the reported decision, that all taxpayers considering the use of a tax shelter to avoid tax liability are in a position to foresee that the IRS might determine that the desired tax benefits are unavailable. And then goes on from that proposition to basically say that because the loss of tax benefits was foreseeable, that we had assumed the risk. And that's a broad sweeping statement because right now Elliot Spitzer and others are out suing accounting firms and law firms for providing the very advice that these insurance brokers provided us on the Coley transaction. Except the Coley transaction didn't deal solely with taxes, it dealt also with life insurance principles. And I don't see why, under any either equitable or legal principles, that as a matter of law, the brokers, consultants, and insurers who put together and sold a flawed program to us can walk away without any responsibility at all. And that's the gist of our claims. And I see that I only have 10 minutes left that I've reserved for rebuttal. Certainly, Your Honors, if you have questions, I'd like to answer them. I'm much more interested in hearing what you have to say than hearing what I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. James Jordan for AIG. My portion of the argument will deal with the no-fault claims, which I guess are characterized by Mr. Horton as equitable claims. Mr. Chasnov will deal with the so-called fault claims, or the legal claims. I think that's what Mr. Horton refers to. And finally, Mr. Cox will talk about the broker, some of the broker issues. To back up for a moment, the original theory that was brought by Walmart with respect to their equitable claims was quasi-contract, rescission for quasi-contract. Obviously, that failed pretty promptly because there is a contract. In fact, there's 350,000 written contracts here. So the quasi-contract theory, Mr. Horton has never proceeded on that theory, in part also because there's really no allegation that there's anything other than reasonable commercial charges that were made under the contract. So the unjust enrichment theory under the quasi-contract never got off the ground. Mr. Horton then changed his approach in later pleadings, and I think the third amended complaint. His primary allegation was restitution for commercial frustration. And he has cited the court to Section 377 of contracts restatement for restitution. Of course, that is the provision for restitution if it can be demonstrated that there was commercial frustration. So you have to turn to Section 265. I believe, and I would say contrary to Mr. Horton, the law is very clear in this area. Section 265 is cited discharge by supervening frustration. And what it says is, and I'll quote, where after a contract is made, a party's principal purpose is substantially frustrated without his fault by the occurrence of an event, the non-occurrence of which was a basic assumption in which the contract was made. And this is what's important. Quote, his, that is to say, Walmart's, remaining duties to render performance are discharged. That's what commercial frustration implies. Judge Lamb, Vice Chancellor Lamb said, well, commercial frustration clearly doesn't apply here because this contract is not still in existence. The benefits under this contract have already been rendered to Walmart. They got the death benefits. They got the cash values. These contracts all were began to be terminated in 1996. By the year 2000, they were all terminated. So there was nothing further to be done by either party, let alone by Walmart. Now, there's another reason why there should be no claim for frustration of purpose, and that is that to assert a valid claim for frustration of purpose, you have to demonstrate that there was a substantial frustration such that, quoting from the restatement, such that the primary objective would render the contract virtually worthless. Now, in order to test that issue, you have to look at what Walmart said was their purpose. Provide certain free death benefits to employees and to provide certain cash benefits to Walmart. Both of those happened during the period of time that these contracts were in effect. Example, $50,000 life insurance policy on an employee of Walmart. The employee was to get $5,000. Walmart got $45,000. Those employees who died during the time that these contracts were in effect, that's how the contracts operated. So those were the first two benefits they said they needed. The third was to provide tax benefits. What were those three tax benefits? One, tax-free buildup under the policies. That happened. There's no allegation that there wasn't tax-free buildup under the policies. Second, tax-free death benefits, when the death benefits were paid. No allegation that that didn't happen. It did happen. And third, tax deduction with respect to the interest paid on the loans that were taken under the contracts, which was part of the program for getting ultimate benefits for them. As they negotiated with the IRS, they got 20% of those benefits instead of 100% of benefits. So Judge Vice Chancellor Lamb held the second reason why there's no claim for frustration. The third reason why there's no claim for frustration is based on an allocation of risk. If the risk is allocated under the contract, you can't, and if it's allocated to the taxpayer, then the taxpayer can't come back and say, this was commercially frustrated. Now, I would turn the court's attention to the letter of understanding that was entered into on the date the policy was signed, all these policies, in December of 1993. And it says, quote, client has reviewed with its own legal and tax advisors, client being Walmart, all present and future implications of its ownership of the policies, including, but not limited to, the tax consequences of loans and or withdrawals from the policies, and the deductibility thereof, and has not relied upon any representations of AIG Life or any employee, broker, or agent. Now, 5 days before that, a letter was sent, a letter actually that Walmart is attempting to rely upon as some sort of representation by AIG. That letter is in Exhibit B-2223. It's from Mr. Larry Waters of AIG Life. It is quoted to you in the briefs by Walmart with substantial ellipses, eliminating what are pretty germane parts of that letter. What's quoted to the court is, Mr. Waters says, the policies have been designed so that if at least the first 7 annual premiums are not paid in the amounts and in the manner set forth in the policies will terminate in accordance with the terms thereof. Accordingly, Pursuant to AIG Life's understanding of AIG Life's understanding of IRC Section 264, the policies are structured, and this is what they're saying was our representation, to allow the trust the flexibility of having no part of four annual premiums due during the first 7 policy years. What's ellipsed out of that is the following. Please be reminded, however, that the trustee has certain rights under the policies, the exercise of which are beyond the control of AIG Life. For example, the amount, frequency, and use of policy loans and or withdrawals, which could cause disqualification under Code Section 264. Precisely what happened here. 5 days before these contracts were entered into. The immediately preceding page also ellipsed a substantial part of it. Quote, since there currently is no IRS guidance in the form of rulings or regulations that might help us determine the proper interpretation of Code Section 7702A, AIG Life is unable to guarantee that its interpretation of said code section will be those adopted by the IRS. Now, to suggest that they didn't assume the risk that these deductions would be disallowed under Section 264 for purposes of commercial frustration, we suggest, is just pure and unadulterated argument on the part of Walmart, not supported by any facts whatsoever. Now, Walmart cites, we cited to Great Lakes. Walmart cited that case, says that case doesn't support us. In Great Lakes, as the court probably knows, there were disclaimers in the contract. And the court in Great Lakes held that those disclaimers precluded the bringing of a case for commercial frustration and for equitable fraud. And we believe that that case controls here. In that case, the only